Today is Thursday, September 19th. We're starting chapter 5, looking at page 54. All right, so you've been through talking about epithelial tissues and connective tissues. We've talked about membranes. So our next logical step in the hierarchy of the human body is to talk about organs and organ systems. So finally today, with what, you know, many weeks into the course, we are finally starting true honest-to-goodness anatomy and physiology with an organ system. And so this organ system is our first encounter with the human body, and actually it does serve as the first encounter for viruses and bacteria that come in contact with your body as well. So the integumentary system is our first organ system. It includes not just skin, but it also includes other things like nails, hairs, glands. So it's much more of a complex organ than just being skin alone. Okay, so at the top of your worksheet there, page 54, what are the two layers of skin? Epidermis and dermis, good. Which is the outermost of the two? Epidermis, good. Okay, and so part of what we're going to do in this chapter is learn why we need our skin, but you can imagine what life would be like without skin. What do you think would happen to the internal organs if there was no skin? Fall out, right? Illness would be rampant. We would have viruses and bacteria attacking us. We'd also dry out. So there's a lot of very important reasons why we need our skin, to include keeping us hydrated, protecting our underlying organs and tissues, protecting us from viruses, bacteria, and other things that can attack our bodies. So we've actually got those written down on a page later on. We'll come back and detail them if you want to look ahead. Those reasons are over on page 60. All right, so there's two main layers to our skin. The epidermis is the outermost portion. What type of tissue composes your epidermis? It is epithelial, it is stratified squamous, good. All right, so back when I was in middle school, they would always go around and jokingly say, oh, your epidermis is showing, and people would panic and look down and think, oh my gosh, what's hanging out, you know? Little did they know, right? So yeah, epidermis is what we can see. Epi, of course, is a prefix, means what?
Over.
Over, upon. Good, so it is, of course, the outermost portion of our skin. You'll notice there's a couple of blanks for us to talk about in terms of types of cells. Let's first talk about the types of cells we find in your epidermis. The type of cell that makes keratin in your epidermis is called a keratinocyte, and that word is up here if you need it. All right, so keratin is, of course, a waterproofing protein. It makes your skin dry. It also makes your skin tough, and it makes your skin an impenetrable barrier against things like viruses and bacteria making their way to deeper layers of your skin. In this picture, you can see the outermost portion of the stratified squamous tissue is covered with it looks like a thin layer of keratin, but it's enough to waterproof and keep fluids from leaving our body. And just as important, it keeps fluids from entering our body as well. So keratin can be, you know, the outermost protective boundary to our stratified squamous layers, and that is part of this waterproofing aspect of our integumentary system. The next term there is a cell that produces melanin, and those cells are called melanocytes. What color is the pigment melanin? Brown, good. So in this picture, you can actually see melanocytes and the melanin they produce in the bottommost layers of the epidermis. So this is a great review for us. The topmost stuff in this picture is generally epithelial tissue, stratified squamous. And then look at the much thicker, deeper dermis down below. Do you recognize what kind of connective tissue this is? Dense irregular, good. So there's a much thicker piece of tissue we're trying to protect. So you'll notice where the melanocytes are housed. They're housed in the bottom of your epidermis, not the top of your epidermis. So all of this dark pink here in the picture is actually melanin that's stained up nice and pretty. That melanin is a kind of a brownish color, and it helps to protect the underlying dermis. As your epidermis ages, what do you think happens to those melanin pigments? They may not work as well, and where do they go? Do they stay where they're at?
No.
They migrate? Apical surface, exactly, yeah. Yes, how you lose your tan. Yes, so any sun exposure you get that causes your skin to produce more melanin, well, only last about 2 to 4 weeks because that melanocyte production is stimulated by UV radiation. So, you know, constantly we are producing new melanin from those melanocytes, and constantly that's being sloughed off the top of your skin. So, you know, we're not looking at a permanent change in color if you're exposed to sun. If you're not exposed anymore, of course, that change in your skin tone goes away. I did want to show you some more pictures of melanocytes. They kind of look like spiders. And these arms that you see sticking up here are full of the pigment melanin. They actually break off and reside inside of a keratinocyte. So it's kind of a cool hangout place. You've got keratinocytes that are making keratin, and you've got melanin hanging out on the inside. So together, the keratin and the melanin ride to that apical surface to be sloughed off. Interesting thing, though, about melanin. We know that it produces in response to UV radiation. We know that it promotes skin darkening. And there's an interesting link here. Do you know what vitamin you make in exposure to the sun?
Vitamin D.
Vitamin D, right. And if you sit out in the sun for 10 or 15 minutes per day, you make about what your body needs in terms of vitamin D. Let's say that you were outside for 8 or 10 hours a day. What can happen to your skin? Damage your skin, get sunburned. And of course, vitamin D helps to regulate bone metabolism. If you're outside for 8 or 10 hours a day, you could cause changes in the way that your bones are structured. In fact, you could cause bad changes in the way that your bones are structured. So darkening of the skin is not just about skin protection. It's also about maintaining just the right amount of vitamin D production and maintaining bone health. Who would have thought that darkening your skin in response to sunlight actually maintains proper bone? So that's another reason we have these melanocytes and melanin, is to make sure that the calcium regulation and phosphorus regulation in our bodies is at the right level. And that's actually vitamin D's job. We'll come back and talk about that in just a minute, too. In addition to melanin, we'll talk about keratin in a little bit as well. You know, keratin's a yellowish pigment that we have in our skin. Some people have in their skin as well. I did want to mention just a little bit about UV radiation. There's actually two types of UV radiation that we're exposed to. There's a UVA and a UVB radiation. You'll notice that A penetrates all the way through the epidermis and the dermis. That's how you can get skin damage, because if you get down into that dermis, that can cause permanent wrinkles and skin problems, sagging skin later in life. UVB only penetrates through the epidermis of the skin. And you can, in fact, get one of these through the glass of your windows in your car. And this is an interesting case here. This man was a truck driver for nearly 30 years. And you can see that the left side of his face was exposed to sun. Notice how it sags and is wrinkled. The right side of his face was a little more shaded by the car, so he's got less problems on the skin on that right side. So really does tell the story of how UV radiation can impact your skin. The third blank there for us to fill in is Langerhans cells. Back in the 1850s, when these cells were discovered, the man who discovered them thought they looked kind of like neurons. And, you know, neurons have axons and dendrites, thus the name dendritic cells. But, and this is a big but, they are not neurons. They are not part of your nervous system. In fact, these Langerhans cells are part of your immune system. So don't let the dendritic alternate name there throw you off. These are not neurons and have nothing to do with the nervous system. These cells actually patrol the outer layers of your epidermis, and it is their job to be macrophages. So what are they doing for a living? Eating baddies, right. So bacteria, viruses, whatever comes in contact with your skin, these Langerhans cells ingest them. They eat them. So as we get older, our skin tends to thin. And of course, along with that becomes more risk for damage to the underlying cells and tissues. And another problem that arises as we age is we have less of these Langerhans cells to digest bacteria. That's why older people tend to have more skin infections. You know, things like decubitus ulcers may form because they just don't have the thickness in their skin like they used to, in addition to having less Langerhans cells as they get older. So they kind of look like neurons. I can see how he might have mistaken these for neurons and came up with the name of dendritic cells. They do have those extensions. All right, how about questions on keratinocytes, melanocytes, or Langerhans cells? I'm going to give you a moment here. Number two has 5 skin layers. I'll give you a moment to jot down corneum, lucidum, granulosum, spinosum, and basal. What's your mnemonic? That's good. You got another one? Oh, that's a good one, too. And if you need a third one, bottoms up, it goes, better students give love and care. So it just depends on how you want to learn it, top down or bottoms up. All right, so far we've got corny Lucy's grandma spent billions. We've got come, let's get sunburned. Those are both top to bottom. And if you want to do the opposite, it's better students give love and care. I want to mention why there is a star beside Lucidum. It is only found where? Palms and soles, right. So every other part of your skin does not have Lucidum. It's only, in fact, 4 major strata in the rest of your skin. All right, so let's start with stratum corneum. The word corn is actually a clue because people get corns and calluses on the outermost portions of their skin. What do you think those corns and calluses are made of? Dead cells. Yeah, and what waterproofs your skin? Yeah, so it's keratinocytes, dead cells that have accumulated, they've dried out, they've packed tight, and so those corns and calluses that people get on their body parts, like their feet, are just accumulations of dead keratinocytes and keratin. It is gross. So if you happen to see dead skin coming off your body, whether it's dandruff from your head or, you know, dried out skin from your arms and legs, that's actually just stratum corneum that is being sloughed off. Mm-hmm. When we shave, if you shave, then you're actually removing cells from that stratum corneum layer. There's no blood going to this epithelial tissue, so as long as you're just scraping off, you know, stratum corneum, you shouldn't see any bleeding coming from that. In fact, where are blood vessels? The dermis, right. So hopefully we're not shaving that hard that we scrape down to that dermis layer. All right, so you'll notice that cells stay at stratum corneum for about 2 weeks before they're sloughed off. washing, of course, and things like shaving, even clothing, can help remove away those dead skin cells. They say that if our eyes could have microscopic abilities, you would actually see people shedding dead skin cells all the time. So it's kind of a gross thought to think that as you walk, you're like this pig pen of dead skin cells that are just leaching off your body. But if we could see at that level, that's what they say we're doing, is we're just like a whirlwind of dead stuff leaching off the outermost layers of our skin. We've already talked about the next bullet point, which is lucidum. It is the extra thickness that we find in our palms and our soles. It's not really that many layers, you'll notice in this picture here. It's not a significant amount of cells, but it's enough to give an extra bit of padding to those palms and those soles of our feet. Let's see, the next layer down is called stratum what? Granulosum, good. And what does that sound like it's got in those cells?
Grains,
yeah. In fact, there are little granules or grains in there that make these cells look dark. Guess what those grains are? Melanocytes, yeah. So you got melanin that's packaged in these cells. You'll notice in this picture, stratum granulosum is a dark layer. And you're not going to see this unless you pull it up in a microscope. But that dark region through the skin is going to be stratum granulosum. That's full of some melanin. As we come down deeper into the epidermis, we now reach stratum spinosum. And this is an actively dividing layer of skin cells. And when I say layer, I actually mean there's more than just one layer here. There's more like 8 to 10 layers of cells actively dividing. So we're getting down to the portion of your epidermis where mitosis is taking place. So where do all these older cells above this region, where do they get pushed to? Going up, yeah. So eventually these stratum spinosum cells will be pushed up towards stratum corneum, and then they're sloughed off. What do you think is happening in the very bottommost layer, stratum basal? Making new ones, yeah. So that's your mitosis layer as well. That's the basement of our epidermis. And those cells are producing, melanin, keratin, and they're going to be pushed up toward the uppermost surface. And then eventually, in about 4 weeks, they're sloughed off. So that's significant. You'll notice under stratum basal there, it takes 15 to 30 days. That's 2 to 4 weeks in order for the cells in your stratum basal to reach the stratum corneum and be lost. What that means is, if you've got something that damages your skin and it affects stratum basal, you're looking at 2 to 4 weeks to repair. If you're talking about sun exposure and extra darkening of your skin, that takes 2 to 4 weeks to grow off and be replaced by new skin cells. So the thing here is that your skin does grow fast, but it still takes 2 to 4 weeks to get new cells from the bottom here all the way up to the very topmost at stratum corneum. All right, so just want to repeat this important piece. If we're looking at skin on your arm, on your face, on your belly, anywhere else except for palms and soles, how many strata do you have in total? 4, right? So the 4 that you've got are corneum, granulosum, spinosum, and basal. The only place you have an extra 5th layer is where? Palms and soles, right? So you need that extra layer for a little cushioning there. I wanted to show you some pictures. You notice again, stratum corneum near the top. You can see the dark layer of granulosum through there. We know basal is the bottommost layer that contacts the underlying connective tissue. You start to get a feel for how this is the trend in all these epithelial tissues. You've got a huge, thick corneum. Lucidum, if it's present, would be right up against granulosum, that dark layer, spinosum, and then basal. I want you to notice how the basal layer is groovy. It connects to that underlying connective tissue by a groovy effect. So the reason for that is to not have those layers slip off of each other. Just another up-close view there of lucidum and granulosum. Where must this slide have come from? Palms are your soles, exactly. And another look at lucidum there and granulosum. This is a pretty cool picture because, you know, we've just simply, you know, in the past said, hey, this is epithelial tissue, it's stratified squamous. Now we know that all of this stuff up top here is stratum what? All that stratum corneum. You know, it looks like there's probably a lucidum layer. Lucidum means clear layer. And it looks like right through there is a slightly clear layer. And then right underneath that is a dark layer, and that's probably stratum what? Granulosum. These cells in here are stratum spinosum, and the bottommost layer of cells, stratum basal, right? And then again, you can recognize this other stuff as dermis down below. Just another look here at the foot. Of course, the corneum's on the right-hand side of this picture. There's a really nice layer of stratum granulosum, spinosum, and then basal. But it really drives home the point that on an area like the foot where there's a lot of abrasion, you're going to have a really thick set of stratum corneum. That's a lot of cells there that are packed into that corneum layer. All right. Any questions so far about the five strata? Okay, so very bottom of your page, let's talk about skin pigmentation. So we can be basically rainbow Skittles in terms of our colors. And, you know, we don't often think about all the colors that our skin can be and what that tells to us. So let's just start with some normally colored pigments. First off is carotene. And what color is carotene? Kind of an orangey yellow, yeah. Some people who have Asian background actually naturally produce carotene in their skin. Gives their skin kind of a yellowish tint. Anybody else who doesn't have that background can actually eat a bunch of carotene-rich foods and turn their skin that color. So, you know, I've always heard stories when we do this class. Somebody knows a kid that loved orange food and turned themselves orange. Do you know somebody?
Oh, my son.
Did he turn himself orange?
So carrots like you get at the Japanese place.
Oh, yeah.
Carrots. Yeah.
Turn orange.
Yeah, and pumpkin pie.
Oh, yeah. Two good ones to turn orange. Mm-hmm. So if you eat a lot of beta carotene-rich foods and you do have pale skin, this stuff is deposited in the bottommost regions of your epidermis, and guess how long it takes to grow out?
2 weeks.
2 to 4 weeks, yeah. So if you stain yourself orange from the inside out, then it's 2 to 4 weeks to get rid of that color. Buyer beware. They advertise oftentimes, you know, about getting tan or quick tans. Take this pill, get a quick tan. Oh, gosh, don't. It's carotene. You will not be tan. You will be orange. So, and 2 to 4 weeks later, you'll be back to normal. But yikes, yeah, that's unfortunate to be stained orange. So carotene there, of course, is yellow-orange. We've talked about melanin, which is a brownish-black color of skin pigmentation. Almost everybody has melanin in their skin, no matter what shade we are. The only people who completely lack melanin have a skin disorder. It's called albinism, right? So no matter what, most people have some level of melanin. Not everybody has carotene, though. What populations have carotene? Asian, right. Okay, so let me flip you on over. We'll talk about hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a pigment found on your red blood cells. That tells you what you need to know. Red blood cells are red due to a combination of oxygen and iron on hemoglobin. So when you are oxygenated, your skin will appear somewhat pinkish or red in tone. When you're deoxygenated, meaning lack of oxygen, guess what color you turn? Blue, yeah. So, in fact, that blue color that you turn when you're deoxygenated has to do with the melanin and the way the eye perceives that coloration. All right, so hemoglobin makes us appear red. If you're sick, if you're hot, if you're running a fever, if you have inflammation, then your skin may appear more red than normal. And it may in fact appear hot to the touch thanks to the increased blood flow to that area. So erythema or ethemia is actually an increased blood flow to a certain area, and it may make our skin appear more red than it should. All right, so if someone is cyanotic, what color are they? They are blue. And so to our eye, cyanosis appears bluish or even purplish in color. And what does that tell us is happening to the oxygen content of their bloodstream? Yeah, it's really low. Good. So it can be a warning sign, especially in a hospital setting, that we have somebody not getting enough oxygen. What body parts do we look at for checking cyanosis? Fingernails. Yep. So that's why they oftentimes say don't wear nail polish, right? Because if they turn blue, those nail beds turn blue, then they know that there's not enough oxygen getting to those fingertips. Another common part to turn blue are your lips. Okay, and so if you're cold, that can also reduce blood flow to areas, just as well as low oxygen content can make us appear somewhat purplish or blue. I did want to mention this. Your blood's actually never blue. It's either bright red or dark red. The blue color from cyanosis comes from the way your eye perceives color. So, you know, like I said, pretty much everybody has melanin in their skin. It's the way your eye perceives the brownish melanin in combination with the dark red blood that you actually interpret that as blue. So it's kind of crazy that those two colors mean blue for your brain, but that's just how our brains work. I did want to tell you about this. Don't marry your cousin, right? That's what this is about. In Kentucky, there were some families that had some inbreeding. And that may have been 150 years ago, but unfortunately, that caused a genetic mutation to be passed among the generations. And this guy over here, you'll notice he has somewhat of a blue tint to his skin, and that's actually a condition called methemoglobinemia. Boy, say that one again. That is actually a misshapen red blood cell, or a misshapen, rather, hemoglobin molecule, and it just looks sick in color, right? It looks like a bluish green color, but that is normal for them. And that is a genetic mutation that is passed through a certain lineage of families. Their last name is Fugate, so that's where the blue Fugates comes from. Up until a few years ago, I understand the man in Darlington passed away, but there was a blue guy, silver nitrate, yes, whoops, in Darlington. Yeah, and if you take silver nitrate as a dietary supplement, buyer beware, because it can turn you blue, and I'm talking permanent Smurf blue. So this is not the guy that was in Darlington, but somebody else that had passed away recently. Actually, this guy died from heart disease, completely unrelated to the silver nitrate that he was taking. But nonetheless, once it stains you blue, you are stuck with that color. So silver nitrate, yeah.
They're selling this colloidal silver at the vitamin shops. You take it, you go buy it over the counter.
Boy, you had an enemy, you know. I mean, people just don't know what you can get your hands on. Permanently blue, Papa Smurf blue here. Okay, so we're heading through the rainbow, and the next color is yellow. So this is jaundice. What do we think is probably wrong with this kind of issue? Liver, yep. So liver and gallbladder deal in bile. We'll talk more about those in Bio 211. And that bile is somewhat yellowish green in color. If it backs up where it can get into your blood system and taint your skin, then of course everything, including the whites of your eyes, can be tainted with that yellow color. And again, how long does it take to get rid of? Yeah, if it's tainting your skin, it may take 2 to 4 weeks to get rid of. It also can be expedited by a blue light.
We did that for my children.
Put them in a blue light.
Breast bed, so they got to back up.
Oh, yeah.
With the amylase.
Had to have that first poop to get that to move, yeah.
Well, no, it took 2 weeks with both of my kids.
Oh, wow.
They had their liver function strong every day. Every morning, they did a heel stick for my babies.
Ouch. That has to hurt. Hurts you more than it does them.
I had to nurse them every 2 hours to flush their system out, give them enough breast milk process.
Wow.
To flush their system out.
Wow. That's hard on you. Yeah.
It's scary.
Yeah.
And then they look like little aliens because there's a bell instead of the light, uh-huh. there's a belt that you rent and you put right around the baby.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's cool. Instead of having to be in a blue box like that.
You take them home, you just cook them on the belt.
Like you've got a little roast, turn it. Yeah, back the day before this, what did they do with babies who had jaundice?
Put them in a window.
Yeah, put them outside. Put them in a window, yeah. How interesting.
You must. They were orange looking.
Wow, they must have had to have the belt.
I've got
yeah.
pictures of them when they were so orange. I got pictures of them wearing a little crazy belt.
Oh. Well, the reason for that in some cases is when babies have not yet had their first poop, then their bile ducts are blocked and the bile backs up into the bloodstream. Usually once they have their first bowel movement, then the tubes unplug and then things start moving. But unfortunately, that can lead to what they call physiological jaundice in a newborn. All right, so next we've got unusual skin bronzing. You know, normally we expect a person's skin to darken if they've been outside exposed to sunlight. But sometimes people turn darker and they haven't necessarily been exposed to sunlight. And in that case, we point the finger at the adrenal glands. The adrenal glands are linked up with the brain, and of course, the adrenal glands are found sitting where?
Kidneys.
Top of the kidneys, right. So if a person has adrenal gland disorder issues, then there is a link or connection with hormones back to the brain. And that may cause the brain to hypersecrete a melanocyte-stimulating hormone. Guess what happens to their skin then? Get darker, right? So melanocyte-stimulating hormone from this disorder means that a person's skin may darken. It may not be a full body darkening, but it may be patchy darkening like you see in this picture. Now everybody's going to run home and look at their gums.
Let me show you what looks like. This looks like here. Do you see the pigment on her gums? So normally people don't use sun exposure to their gums. Nobody goes outside and grins like this. So we can probably safely say this is not suntan or sun exposure. It's not freckling on her gums. That's probably not the only warning sign she had. She probably had a whole host of other issues, like JFK in this picture. They thought that he might die in office. Well, he did die in office, but not for the reason they thought. They thought he might die in office because he had Addison's disease. I don't think it's been confirmed, but his inner circle of friends thought he was very sickly, had low blood pressure, very weak, and along with that goes this random place splotches of skin darkening. So, you know, had he lived long enough, that might have been something that would have killed him from not having, you know, blood pressure and sodium and potassium regulated like it should. So interesting disorder there. More Addison's disease. This can be gum cancer, you know, down here. That looks like it's a pretty serious case of skin darkening. So of course, anytime you've got patches of melanin show up inside your mouth, you should have somebody check that for you. But nonetheless, it could be multiple things. It could be a melanoma cancers in the gums. It could also be a case of Addison's disease. This is an unfortunate condition because vitiligo destroys melanocytes. So what happens to the skin when the melanocytes are damaged? No color, right? So a person has patches where there's absolutely no melanin. And what does that leave you at risk for?
Skin cancers,
yeah. Sunburns, skin cancers. So this guy is actually a newscaster, and I saw a video on him one time. He would take makeup and patch himself back up and then go on the news. No one knew he had the condition because he had put on makeup so well. The unfortunate thing is this is a progressive disease. They think it's autoimmune.
It'll spread, right?
It can spread, yeah.
It's in
my family.
Has spread on her. They think it might be autoimmune. They're not entirely certain what the background for this disease is. They do know that vitamin B12 shots tend to slow the pace of this disease. So it may not be the best solution, but it seems to work for some people who have vitiligo.
This was Michael Jackson's disorder. You know, he had actually shut off melanin production, so his entire body lightened. And you could do that. You know, you can manipulate melanocyte-stimulating hormone and shut off melanin production. But anybody who does that is, of course, higher risk for sunburns and skin cancers. Freckles can be genetic. Freckles can also be sun exposed and induced. So, you know, you may have a genetic component that causes your skin to freckle. Liver spots are actually somewhat like freckles, except their borders are different. So as people age, if they had sun exposure earlier in life, these may show up later in life. And unfortunately, you know, if you're 20 or 30 and you're getting sun exposure, you don't realize that 20 or 30 years later, this may be the result, is these splotches of, you know, splotches of pigmentation on your skin. All right, and then we talked about this one. This one's albinism, and it's a lack of pigment production, not only in the skin, but the hair and the eyes too. So people with this disorder end up having oftentimes eye cancer, retinosa pigmentosa, from having had sun exposure, and they're at high risk for skin cancers. So this is a well-understood genetic condition. It is a recessive disorder. So you can have two parents completely normally pigmented, and if they carry the recessive allele for this disorder, then they can have a kid with this. Yeah, 25% chance.
They just have no sun protection.
No sun protection, right. Do y'all have any questions? Oh, we got a blank to fill in, don't we? Okay, so under cyanosis, there's a question that says, why do you think bruises appear blue? What do you think the skin is not getting?
Oxygen.
Yeah, so it's due to a lack of oxygen. Okay, so the reason that skin appears blue when it's bruised is due to a lack of oxygen. Okay, so let me give you a side detour for just a moment. So if you've ever had a really awful bruise, it looks somewhat black, it looks somewhat blue. That's the skin dying. That is the lack of oxygen, makes it appear blue. Leave it alone long enough, it turns yellow and green, right? So if you leave the blood cells there alone, they will continue to break down and make something that's yellowish in appearance. Not jaundice, right? But in fact, the yellowish green color is the next phase of breakdown. Red blood cells go through the same path. When you take them to the liver, they're broken down and they're made into bile, which of course is yellowish green. So red blood cells basically go through this pathway of death. It's kind of like a rainbow of colors. So that yellowish green color is actually the same reason that bile is the same yellowish tint. So just thought that was an interesting connection there. All right, looks like we're ready for dermis, about halfway down the page. How about questions so far? Learned anything interesting today? Skin's got some good info in here. All right, so where is the dermis located? Dermis is deeper, right? So it's the deeper, thicker portion of your skin. It is protected by the outermost epidermis. This is a great picture here of the epidermis and dermis. This stuff on the outermost region is stratified squamous cells. It's dead keratinocytes. It's keratin. There's your stratum granulosum, that dark layer. What's beneath it? That's it, spinosum, and then the most bottom layer?
Basal.
Basal, good. So underneath that, you've got a much thicker dermis portion of your skin. And in fact, there's two portions of your dermis. You may have to look closely here to see them, but there's actually an upper region called the papillary region and a deeper region called the reticular layer. So if you look really close, it looks like this papillary region, slightly different structure than the underlying reticular layer. So we'll start with what's probably easier there. What do you think the reticular layer is made of?
Connective tissue,
yeah. And it's dense,
irregular,
yeah. And that's easy to spot in this picture.
The papillary region, you'll notice on your worksheet, is actually made up of loose areolar connective tissue. It's somewhat difficult to see in this picture that it's loose areolar. But I did want to show you a cool feature of your skin. The dermal papillae that make the ridges that you can see on your hands and feet come from the papillary region of your dermis. The only place you can really see that ridging effect is on your palms and your soles, but do know that it's everywhere. This pegging effect where your dermis and your epidermis groove together keeps your epidermis from literally slipping and sliding off of your body. So unfortunately, if you had, you know, just a flat, smooth effect instead of the pegging effect, there'd be really nothing to keep, you know, shoes and clothes from rubbing your skin off. Literally, your epidermis would be rubbed off. So this pegging here is called the dermal papillae or papilla. You can see more of that pegging effect there. And what is that papillary made of? What type of tissue? Yeah, loose areolar connective tissue. It is hard to see in this picture. And here you can see more of that grooviness between the stratum basal and that papillary layer of the dermis. And one more. So when you look at, say, fingerprints or footprints and you see the hills and valleys, that actually comes from having just thin enough epidermis, and I know that doesn't sound right, but just thin enough epidermis to be able to see the grooviness of the dermis poking through from the bottom. And I know we just talked about stratum lucidum making the palms and soles an extra layer thick, but the skin there has to be just thin enough in order for you to get the grip that you need in order to do whatever jobs we do with, you know, that grooving texturizes your palms and your soles. Imagine doing whatever we do daily without having those grooves on your hands and your feet. All right, so epidermal ridges are the names for what you see here. These top pieces sticking up is what creates a fingerprint. They say that it's unique genetically, and they also say that it forms from having us touch the inside of our mother's wombs during pregnancy. So they say that somehow drives the designs that we get on our hands and our feet. But nonetheless, those fingerprints and footprints should be unique to each one of us. Let's go and look now at the deeper reticular layer. We know that it's got a lot of dense irregular connective tissue down here, very tough type of tissue that binds your epidermis and dermis to the underlying hypodermis and muscle tissue. So this is a tough layer. It does have blood vessels like the reticular layer or the papillary layer. There's nerves down here. So the entire blood supply for your epidermis comes from this dermis down below. Let's talk about the collagen and elastic fibers here. What is the purpose of collagen in the dermis of your skin? What does it provide? Strength, right? Collagen is very strong. It's flexible, but the strength is what we need from those collagen fibers. What do the elastic fibers do for us? Stretch, right? So you kind of get a double whammy here. You get not only the strength from collagen, but the real stretch from those elastic fibers. All right, so if you happen to damage this layer as through stretch marks, oops, I'm going the wrong direction. Let me go back this way. Then we actually get tears in the dermis of the skin. That means there are tears in that loose areolar and dense irregular connective tissue region. And unfortunately, dense irregular is not a fast grower. So we may be left with permanent tears in that region of our skin. If you tear the that portion of your dermis, you just lost the strength of the collagen fibers and the stretch of the elastic fibers. So that skin will no longer have the underlying support that it needs, that it would normally have there. Let's talk about what happens with blisters. This looks rather painful. This is a henna tattoo. You can have blisters from all sorts of different reasons, including sunburn. But if you blister, you actually create a well of fluid between the dermis and the epidermis. So that's why they say don't pop blisters, because you can now introduce what? bacteria. And if bacteria get into your dermis, where does it go?
Everywhere,
exactly, because blood goes everywhere. This is an interesting concept here. These are called lines of cleavage. Not the kind of cleavage we normally talk about. These lines of cleavage are the way the collagen fibers lay in your dermis. Obviously, we really don't see these much when we look at each other's bodies or even at your own. But if you look at your own hand, you can oftentimes see collagen fiber directions running in your finger. I know that you see the lines in your hand here, and I know that you see where your finger's been. But if you look closely, there's lines that run the length of your finger. Yeah, that's collagen. And those are lines of cleavage. So the reason I point this out is because of surgery. Notice, say, down here in the abdomen, notice how these lines of cleavage point like a V. And if you have a C-section that cuts straight across, how do you think those collagen fibers heal?
They don't.
They don't, right. If you cut along the midline, right there at that V point, you may have a little better chance of healing, but what you're looking for if you cut them is you want those fibers to grow back like they were, not all wonky. You know, so that's the problem with cutting across lines of cleavage. So if a surgeon can help it and go where they do least damage to that line of cleavage, it would help your skin from healing properly. They don't care. They're going to cut where they want to, right? So just a fun tidbit. I do want to go back and mention something rather gross, and that is all the leather products that we use is actually cow dermis. So, yeah.
Or pig.
Yep. All the leather products that we use are dermis. So if it's pig, cow, alligator, snake, you name it, if it's leather, it is dermis. Yeah. And interestingly, there are actually books in libraries in Europe made from human dermis. Yeah. Yeah. So you probably wouldn't know it. It's probably been treated with chemicals to last, and it would be tough just like any other dermis or any other leather, but nonetheless, that's I don't want to be handed that book to handle. All right. So, go ahead. It was a henna allergy, yeah. That really makes you think twice about having a tattoo from henna because you don't know if you're going to have an allergy to it. I had a quick little video to show you all. You reconnect here. Probably, because like just with regular hair dye, they'll say, test it, yeah. But I would probably spot test that before, because I don't know if you would ever know until you had it all on. And imagine if your head were to blister like that. Oh, no kidding. Like, no one touched my head, right?
Can tattoos embrace technology in order to make the skin interactive? The dermal abyss presents a novel approach to bio-interfaces in which the body's surface is rendered an interactive display. Traditional inks are replaced with biosensors whose colors change in response to variations in the intestinal fluid. The pH sensor changes between purple and pink, and the glucose sensor between blue and brown. The sodium and second pH sensor fluoresce at a higher intensity under UV light. The dermal abyss creates direct access to the compartments of the body and reflects inner metabolic processes in the shape of a tattoo. It could be used for applications in continuously monitoring, such as medical diagnostics, quantified self, and data encoding in the body. Preliminary evaluation was done in an ex vivo pig skin model. Several injections in the skin were done in order to understand the visibility and the functionality of the biosensors. In the same way that the wearables industry is integrating fashion practices into their development, We envision new participation between the biotech companies and skin professionals, such as prosthesis experts and tattooists, in order to embrace the idea of human device symbiosis.
Completely in the dark, aren't we?
Trouble hearing? Don't skip this video. If you're suffering from premature hearing loss, the struggle could soon be over, thanks to recent technological advances.
So that video that we just saw were medical tattoos, and what they were showing, of course, was maybe for diabetes, we could have somebody with a medical tattoo that could tell if we had high blood sugar or low blood sugar. And so that may be the future of doing medical testing, is having these tattoos that change color on your skin based on what's happening in the dermis, since it does get a good blood supply. So I thought that was a pretty cool thing for us to look at. All right. So it looks like we finished up page 55. Do y'all have any questions so far on that page? Okay, let's see, page 56, let's talk about the subcutaneous layer. So I want to emphasize that the skin is technically two layers. It's epidermis and underlying dermis. The hypodermis is actually not part of the skin. It is a connective tissue layer that's found deep to the dermis, and it is a connector between your skin and underlying tissue. So on the top of page 56, let me emphasize that hypodermis is technically not part of the two skin layers. You've probably heard of hypodermic injections. They do go into this layer. Oftentimes, it's just fat tissue that's down underneath the dermis of the skin. But, you know, that's heading pretty far up underneath the skin when we're heading to that hypodermis layer. In reality, the hypodermis is only, you know, under the dermis, the epidermis and dermis themselves together, a little bit thicker than a piece of paper towel, but, you know, we're not looking at an incredibly thick piece of tissue here when we put in a hypodermic injection. All right, so hypodermis is oftentimes loose adipose tissue. There may be other loose connective tissues found there. This is a connecting layer between the dermis and the underlying muscle or other types of tissue. And you'll notice there that sometimes loose areolar may be found here as well. So as we age and this skin layer, you know, becomes looser, then body skin tissues can oftentimes sag. So that's part of the sagging of skin, comes from the looser, less strong collagen fibers in the dermis in combination with fat that just doesn't really hold any structure ever. So that's unfortunate about the way fat works. Pretty cool picture there of skin. You've got the dermis and the epidermis at the very top, and then way down below here you've got the base of the hair follicles embedded in that loose adipose connective tissue. All right, looks like we're ready for page 57. Let me flip you on over there. So this is a system. We are talking about the integumentary system. It includes not only the epidermis and dermis, but also accessory organs like hair, nails, and even glands. So let's tackle hairs first. Hair is found pretty much everywhere on your body except for a couple of main regions. Where are they? No hair on your palms? Soles of your feet? Good, your lips? This is getting gross. Genitalia? Nipples? Okay, so no hair on palms, soles, lips, nipples, or external genitalia. And I think that makes sense, right? Babies don't want to nurse mamas who have hairy nipples. No one can open a doorknob with hairy palms. Imagine walking in your shoes with hairy, you know, soles of your feet. So it makes sense why there's just no hair on certain surfaces. So the interesting thing is hair and fingernails actually have a lot in common with the way that they're structured. Hairs and nails both grow from what's called a follicle. And in this picture, if you'll look at this kind of a bluish color, you know, you've got coming down below here, this is actually stratum basal that's looping down really deep into your skin, down below the skin into your hypodermis, and this follicle is what gives rise to your hairs and to your nails. So this follicle is actively dividing stratum basal cells. Those follicle cells in turn help the root of the hair or the root of the nail to grow. So if you damage the follicle, what happens to hair growth? Stops, right, no more hair growth. All right, so that's a blank for us to fill in. If the follicle is damaged, what happens to growth? It stops. One good way to damage a follicle and cause permanent hair damage is to use electrolysis. That can kill those cells in stratum basal down here in this region. And if they're dead, then the cells can no longer make new hairs or even new fingernails. People who pluck hairs routinely oftentimes can damage those follicles. And of course, over many years of plucking hairs, you may eventually cause the follicle to just go dormant and stop producing hairs. When people go bald, the hairs fall out of these entrapments down below, and the follicles are not very quick to replace the hairs, so that means that there's just lack of hair growth in that region. So people tend to lose their hair where the follicles become dormant more than they're active. So we really got to give those follicles their props for what they do in terms of keeping our hair growing. This piece of your hair down here, that's kind of a bulb-shaped ending, is called the hair root. That too has to grow. Okay, so if you damage the hair follicle, the root can't grow. If you damage the root, the hair also won't grow. All right, so that next question, how is hair growth affected if the root is damaged and the hair falls out? Well, it can regrow as long as what is still functional. As long as the follicle is still functional. Okay, so if you damage the root and the hair falls out, it can regrow. It can regrow as long as your follicle is still functional. Okay, so it can regrow as long as that follicle is still functional. So plucking hairs out simply takes the hair and its root out of this growing follicle region. You know, and if we do that enough, we can oftentimes damage the follicle, like I mentioned, and then the hair just, it won't grow back, yeah. So just be careful what you pluck, right? Because the follicle may say, all right, you just don't want me here, I'm done growing, and that may be the end of it.
That's why Granny has no eyebrows.
That's why she has what?
Oh,
right, right. Eventually the follicle say, I'm done here. Nobody won't me.
About a little pencil thin line in the 50s. So
and then that's it. Yeah. No more hair growth.
Yeah. She draws more.
But that is a danger. You're right. Because, you know, and imagine somebody who damages their follicles on their head, too. That could cause baldness or permanent hair loss. Yeah. Sure.
Why would they use a laser on your head in the first place? Is that a reason for killing cancer in the brain? Or?
Oh, I don't know. It depends on what they're doing, what their goal is.
Well, there's laser hair removal.
Right.
That
would be like electrolysis. It would kill those follicles from growing back new hairs. But it depends on, you know, is their target the skin or is their target something else up there?
When you kill those follicles, though, what else could it be doing to your other skin cells?
Well, you wonder if they were to hit stratum basal of the skin, it probably impairs their growth as well. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll just be fuzzy.
We can all be fuzzy with Bella's hairs, yeah. So this is kind of cool. This is a real hair and a follicle. The stratum basal is this layer coming down. It loops below the hair root there and goes back up. And that's what we've got to keep intact and growing if we want to have viable hairs. This piece of the hair down below here is called the hair root. And eventually, we don't have the picture, but it would stick up off the top of the skin. That portion's called the what? The shaft, right. And interestingly, what we see when we look at each other is dead stuff. We see dead keratinocytes on our skin. We see dead hair, which is keratin again. So, you know, we consider ourselves living, but what we see is actually dead stuff. So, yep, all that hair, of course, is dead collagen and keratin. So in this picture, the pretty purple color coming down, that is our stratum basal. It comes way far away from its home up there in the epidermis. It comes down here to this hypodermis region. No wonder hairs hurt if you pull them out, right? All right, so the next two blanks for us to fill in. Hair is made of blank A protein. What do you think?
Keratin.
Keratin, yeah. And the pigment there is due to melanin. Yep, good. So keratin and melanin. All right, so on this, we'll all be taking naps soon. So on this picture, you'll notice there's a piece of muscle tissue connected to this hair. And that piece of muscle tissue right there is called the erector pili muscle. Literally, erector means it's going to stand them how? Straight up, right. Pili means hair. So literally, the muscle's name is I stand hair straight up. Yeah. So under what conditions might your hairs need to stand straight up? Cold, scared, yep. So if you're cold or if you're scared, your hairs are stood on end. And when we do that, we actually trap heat closer to our bodies. Well, that's good if you're cold because it insulates air around your body. Now, if you're scared though and your hairs stand on end, we don't look any different to each other than if your hairs were laying flat down. Other animals that have a lot more hairs than us, how do they look when their hairs stand on end? Like a porcupine, right? They look, I'm big, I'm tough, leave me alone. You know, so when cats get scared and they poof their hair, you know.
Squirrel tail.
Yeah, they go poof. You're like, okay, I gotcha, you know. So the thing with us is we really can't see when our hairs stand on end, but we know it ourselves personally because we feel the goosebumps associated with that. But really no purpose for that for scared for us, but of course important for other animals. Let's talk about types of hairs that you've got. We have two types of hairs. One is called a vellus hair, and it's a really fine peach fuzz type hair. And the other is a terminal hair, which is the colorful, thick hairs that we have. Where do you think terminal hairs are often found? Head hairs, right. Okay, so head hairs, armpit hairs, groin hairs are terminal hairs. They are thicker and more heavily pigmented hairs. You may not think you've got hair on your forehead, but you've got vellus hairs there. The inside of your arm may feel like it's not hairy, but in fact, there's teeny tiny peach fuzz hairs. Those are vellus hairs. In little kids that are approaching puberty, the vellus hairs in their armpits and groin become more heavily pigmented, and then they transition to what? Terminal hairs.
Is
right.
That like, when I was little, born, yeah, like, he was really hairy.
Babies actually have a peach fuzz on them that may probably will fall out. And then hormones can actually make them have hairs in places that they may not normally have them. So if that hair fell out after he was born, it's probably just hormonally driven. But yeah, most babies have a little...
No, he had a lot of hair. He's really hairy. He's still hairy. Like, his back got some hair on
And sometimes that, you know, you're right, it doesn't fall out. Sometimes it does. Yep. The structure of your hair is actually driven by the follicle shape. You know, that follicle is where the hair emerges from. And if it's fairly round, then you're going to have straight hairs. If the follicle becomes more elongated, kind of like an oval, then the hair is going to probably come out and twist, forming some type of curl. So over your lifetime, your follicles may in fact change shape. That may be genetically driven. And so you may start life with stick straight hair and end life with curly hair or go in the opposite direction.
You said this round is straight?
Round is straight, yeah.
And what makes it curly?
If you have more of an oval-shaped follicle, then it will come out curly. You can actually see in these pictures the pigmentation due to melanin. And in this picture, you can see the lack of pigmentation, which is gray hair.
It is like glass.
It is like glass. If it was just as pretty as glass, though, right? So gray hairs, of course, are not just pigment-free. They're more trouble than that. They have air bubbles in them. So gray hairs, you may or may not know, don't behave like regular hairs. They have a mind of their own because they're full of air bubbles. So they may grow wild, they may look different, they may be curly when the rest of your hairs are straight. So the unfortunate thing about them is they kind of take on a life of their own because they have these oxidized air bubbles inside of them. That's why coloring them is very difficult, because they are structurally different than just a regularly pigmented hair. So they say stress can do it, they can turn your hairs gray, but it's mostly genetic that turns your hairs gray. You look at your parents, if you have an early graying parent, then you may be following in their footsteps. My mom turned gray at 16. My hair started turning gray last year at age 23. Yeah, and so.
My mom raised me, her hair
turned
gray.
She blame it on you. Yep, so most of it's genetic in terms of turning those hairs. All right, how about questions about hair? All right, let's see, we're looking at nails. Let's put a note that that's where we're going to start on Tuesday.